start us off now and just introduce first of all Max Nathan, who works here at LSE, both in LSE Cities and at CERC, the Spatial Economics Research Centre. Max has got very diverse and very broad experience. He's talking tonight on cultural diversity in the London economy, but his interest range far beyond this. He's still an associate, works in associate with Demos, Work Foundation with IPPR, so think tank junkie there, and has also worked with the CLG, Communities and Local Government, through the ESRC DCLG as a strategy advisor. But as I say tonight, despite a much broader interest, he's talking to us and asking the question about the value or otherwise of cultural diversity for London's economy. So, thank you, Max.
Thanks. Can you all hear me at the back? I tend to sort of mumble during these things, so if you can't hear me, stick your hands up. All right. Thanks, LSE London, for having me, and thank you all for coming along. Let me just give you a quick idea, if this will behave itself, of what I'm going to talk about. First of all, I need to make sure that actually the slides move, and then I think we can probably start. Okay. So, talk amongst yourselves while I see if I can get the presentation to actually work. Okay. We may have to do it like this, which is not ideal. All right, can you all see that? Okay, so thank you to Microsoft for screwing that up. So four things I want to cover today. Firstly, just to set the scene, I want to talk about some of the sort of big picture demographic trends in the UK and specifically in London. I will then sort of give you a quick flavour of what I'll be calling the economics of diversity literature, which is actually several literatures, the intersection of several literatures, and a field which is small but is growing quite rapidly. When I was doing my PhD work here, this was the sort of stuff that I was most interested in. So I'll give you a quick flavour of what that literature says ought to be happening in London. I'll then draw on a piece of work that I did with Neil Lee from the Work Foundation, looking at links between the cultural diversity of London businesses and things that they do or don't do, specifically aspects of business performance, and then try and draw out some of the policy lessons at the end. Now, two caveats, which some of you will have already spotted. Firstly, I'm an economic geographer, and in LSE that generally means that economics is the sort of most important bit of it. And I use quite a lot of economics. The second thing is that I also use econometrics, so there'll be a little bit of econometrics later on. I'll try and keep that as non sort of jargony and technical as possible. I think it's useful to do this so you get a sense of the size of the effects that I'm getting out of the data rather than just me telling you. Okay. So let me give you some headlines in case you don't want to stay for the whole thing. London exhibits, you know, what various people have termed super diversity, so I'll say a bit more about what I think that means later. And there are a number of drivers of this. Immigration is one, but it's certainly not the only one. When you're thinking about the economic effects of all of this, you need to go well beyond the current sort of policy obsession with immigration and start to think about what bigger, more diverse communities and cities look like, at least in economic terms. And I'll be focusing very much on the economics rather than considering broader social and cultural issues. The work that I've done with Neil suggests that London's diversity has economic benefits for capital's businesses and for those who work in them. The economic effects of immigration on London as a whole and potentially on some Londoners seem a bit more mixed. And I'll say a little about some work that Ian and others have been doing on this. All of that means that the policy mix needs to change, and I'll say a bit at the end about how I think that ought to happen. So let me give you a bit of context to start with. Great. So now this isn't going to work, but maybe it will work if I do this. Okay, it's not going to work. So let me skip on to the next thing. And let me just start getting out the backup presentation I had in case this happened. So look, three stylized facts, which I was hoping to illustrate with that lovely graph that hasn't appeared. The first is that whether you measure it by migration, or minority communities, or linguistic diversity, or religious diversity, the UK is a lot more culturally diverse than it was 20 or 30 years ago. And as Robert Putnam has pointed out, there are a number of other countries for which that's the case as well. As I said earlier, there's more than one driver of this. Immigration is clearly an important part of the story, but as migrant communities settle and stay, start families, you can see other drivers starting to kick in. And if you run these trends forward, as some researchers at Leeds University have done, their prediction is that the minority ethnic communities in Britain might encompass 1 in 5 of the UK population by 2050. Now, obviously, there are a lot of things that could change that, but that's how they extrapolate from existing trends. The third point is that this diversity is urbanised. This has historically been the case. Cities and urban areas have tended to have the largest migrant and minority populations and the biggest sort of population shares. Although A8 accession pushed different groups of arrivals around the country rather more, that sort of urbanised picture hasn't really changed very much. Now, Stephen Vertebeck and others argue that what we've actually had is not only a sort of increase in the quantum of diversity, but also in the composition. And he talks about a number of trends leading to what he calls super diversity. Now, I think that's, there's clearly something in this. If you look at the major sort of sending countries for migration in the mid-90s and then in the late 2000s, those have changed, and the sort of the set of sending countries and the distribution of population for each one has broadened out. As I said earlier, people don't just go home. They become UK citizens, they settle and stay. There are a number of new migrant communities that have appeared, particularly over the last decade. When they have children, children don't always speak English as a first language, and you can see from these DfE figures that the share of kids who set up for ESOL has almost doubled between 2003 to 2009. And I think when the numbers come in from the census, you'll see a likely rise in religious diversity as well. Now, to the extent that super diversity is going on, and this is still a contested term, it's an urban phenomenon, and it's largely a London phenomenon. And if the next slide behaves itself, I'll try and show you some of what I mean by that. If it doesn't, I'll just have to load up another presentation and do it from there. Okay, good, it works. So, some of you may have seen this before. This is from Susie Hall's piece in EPA earlier this year. And what she's done is to go up and down the Woolworth Road. This is my PowerPoint skills, drawing the Woolworth Road for you so you can see it. And she's basically mapping all of the businesses on the Woolworth Road onto their owners' sort of country of origin or roots, and she's defining that in a fairly sort of fuzzy way. What this is showing is that if you just take one South London High Street, you have this extraordinary sort of cosmopolitan mix. Now, obviously, this is Zone 1; it's going to look different in different parts of London, but I would bet you that you could find similar business diversity all over the city if you chose to look. If you look at some of the broader numbers for London, you can see that it exemplifies this sort of cosmopolitan world city image that it's been projecting for itself since the Olympic bid, essentially. It is obviously has a big economic footprint, both in the global system and in the UK system. There's this famous statistic, which is now quite out of date and is probably an underestimate, about the number of languages that London school children are likely to speak. And again, you know, you can sort of cut it in different ways, but it's a diverse city. Importantly, for what I want to come on to, this cultural diversity is seen as both a social asset and also an economic asset by London policymakers, by those in Whitehall, and, you know, in some of the polls that the GLA has run, you know, Londoners share that view as well. So, just to give you a quick, you know, a quick sort of pan out, you know, one view of this is that this is a very new thing, and that we're basically at a, you know, sort of leading edge of a trend which is pretty recent. If you look at this quote from Peter Ackroyd's biography of London, you can see that although this might not be super diversity in the sort of the modern sense of it, you know, the multicultural city or sort of multicultural London has been some kind of reality for a very long time. Equally, you know, worries about multicultural London are also quite old. So in 883 AD, you know, King Alfred famously banned the Danes from London because he feared civil unrest that the Danes might bring. He sent them to live east of the Lee. There were complaints about foreigners practicing their own customs across medieval Britain, according to Vertebeck. Elizabeth I gets in on the act in 1610, and by the end of the 19th century, the Times is complaining that there's hardly such a thing as a pure Englishman on this island, etc., etc. So, I mean, this is, you know, there is a sort of deep history to this, which I think it's important to keep in mind, despite all the, you know, the big numbers I've just shown you. So let's have a think about what, you know, trying to formalise what some of the economic effects of this might be. Now, I've been using the language fairly loosely up till now, and I'm going to try and pin it down a little bit, if only to show you how hard it is to do that act of pinning down. So I'm going to take a very, very simple notion of cultural diversity. I'm doing that because you need some sense of cultural identity in order to do that. And as those of you who work in this field will know, you know, pinning down something as complicated as this is very, very difficult to do. And that means if you try and put numbers to this kind of stuff, which quantitative researchers like me try to do, it makes the job even harder. So the workaround is to take a very, very simple notion of cultural diversity, and, you know, and this is the kind of what is done in the field. You know, you may disagree with this, that's fine. To use very simple identity proxies which capture some of this, so country of birth, the ethnic groups that the Office of National Statistics use, so on and so forth. These are not pretending to capture exactly what it's like to be me or what it's like to be you. These are proxies which have some kind of stability. And the measures that are then used to construct diversity are similarly, you know, parsimonious, I think you could say. So, what might a simple economics of diversity look like? So, economists like to talk about shocks to firms or shocks to areas. So, a diversity shock might take place in sort of two dimensions. The simplest is that, you know, if some immigrants arrive in an area, they will increase the, and they work, they will increase the size of the local labour force, and they might change the composition of the labour force. So there'll be a sort of labour force effect. If they live in the area and buy stuff, then there'll be some wider effects on consumer markets and potentially on other bits of the urban economy. Now, most analysts have tended to work on the labour market side and look at the sort of wages and employment impact of immigrants on the local labour market, and there are obvious political reasons why that's, you know, why there's a demand for that type of work. Now, that analysis predicts, in theory, that the average effect on UK natives, that's the economics language, of immigrants arriving is zero. If you allow labour market institutions to change, migrants to start clustering, some employers to become, quote, migrant dependent, some of those effects might look rather different. And there are a few studies which are sort of suggestive of some of these lockout effects going on. This is not the same as migrants taking jobs. This is actually a whole set of interconnected things going on in different parts of the labour market, connected to deregulation, the use of employment agencies, you know, the arrival of people willing to do low-quality work. Some of the wider effects, the wider effects are basically pretty much underexplored and need further work. And there are multiple channels here. I want to sort of pull out two of them and focus on one set and what I'll show you next. So economists talk about production complementarities from having, in this case, a more diverse workforce, access to co-ethnic networks, presence of highly skilled and dynamic ethnic entrepreneurs. You can see that all of these things might be good for an urban economy and some of the actors within it. Having said that, there are also channels operating in the other direction that might reduce this positive impact, or sort of the welfare positive impact of some of this stuff, or rule it out altogether. At the urban level, we might find basically a kind of amplifying effect of being in a large urban cosmopolitan city like London. On the other hand, if infrastructure doesn't keep pace with population change, then maybe kind of crowding and competition effects. If you look at the evidence that we have, and I'm going to touch on this very briefly, and I'm sure we'll be talking about some of the questions afterwards, kind of the UK-wide studies on labour markets suggest that the average effects, labour market effects of immigrants on labour market prospects of Britons are smaller and significant. If you do this by skill group or occupational group, you find some of the negative effects that labour market institutional change might tend to predict. The studies that have been done in London also have some suggestive evidence of this. They certainly show a clear migrant division of labour with clustering of certain occupations, big role in employment agencies, and also what Jane Wills and Ho called hierarchies of hiring, which is may disadvantage some older migrant groups at the expense of newer ones. The wider effects, as I said, most of the evidence comes from outside the UK. I don't know of any other work that's been done in London apart from the study that I'm going to show you. These tend to show some evidence of these positive externalities of diversity, particularly in an urban context. But these studies tend to vary from country to country, so it's important to do the work in the UK and to do the work in London to find out what's going to happen here. So this is what we did. So until fairly recently, there was this very nice survey, since abolished by the GLA, for budgetary reasons, I think, which provided quite a lot of rich data about firms across Greater London. Labs is nice because it basically means you don't have to spend a lot of time matching up different data sets. So it covers information on workforce ownership, workforce ownership characteristics, lots of aspects of business performance, constraints on business performance. It's not a panel, so we have had to sort of play around with the data a bit in order to make sure that we have or get close to some causal effect. But we have quite a lot of firms, and we have data from 2005 to 2007. We partly chose those years because we wanted to look at what happened after A8 accession in 2004. The data actually goes back a bit further, so we could do something a bit more ambitious with sort of before and after. But we focus very much on what happened after. The other thing that we've done in this paper, although not in other papers, is to focus on people at the top of the firm. So we're looking at the characteristics of business owners and partners, and sort of senior management. In some cases, these are the founders of the firm. That allows us to look at reasons for firm formation. More broadly, we're focusing on people who we argue are the, sort of the decision makers. So if we want to look at the markets that these firms are selling into, we need to look at this group of people, we would suggest. What we then do, and I think this is where I start bringing the econometrics in, is what we're trying to do here is radically simplify what we think firms are doing in real life. Okay, so what we're trying to get at is whether there is any connection between what we've got, our left-hand side variable here, which is whether or not the firm is innovating. We have various measures of innovation, whether it's commercialising those innovations, the type of markets it's selling into, and in some specifications, why the firm was set up in the first place, sort of reasons for formation. And what we want to do is to identify what's going on here, and whether that's having an effect, and whether it's having any statistically significant effect. We're going to control for a bunch of other stuff, which I'll show you in a moment. And what that's designed to do is to try and isolate the div bit from all of the other stuff that might be affecting these outcomes. So our data allows us to cut a few things out and isolate them. First, so we try and identify three types of diverse firm. So we have firms which have a mix of UK and non-UK born partners and owners. We call these migrant diverse firms. We have firms where everyone in the top team is born outside the UK. Labs also asks about ethnicity, but it does it in a less precise way. So we have this measure of sort of ethnic diverse firms which are at least half minority ethnic partners and owners. So that is basically collapsing together those two, which is, this is more of a kind of cross-check variable. What we're going to be doing is looking at the relative effect of being this type of firm versus being a firm which is basically all white British or all UK-born owners and partners. So it's a relative diversity effect. The stuff that we try and control for is here. So these are all things that we might expect will affect the business performance of a company. So how old it is, how big it is, whether it does R&D, whether it collaborates with other firms, or exports, what type of company it is, how smart the management are or aren't, whether it's a sort of knowledge-intensive firm. I'll show you a bit more about that later. And then we have these things which are designed to control for wider trends in the industry and in firms. So what I'm trying to argue here is that we control the way for a whole load of other stuff and get some idea of what the diversity effects are. So let me show you a few of the results and then try and wrap up with what I think this means. So rather than give you the full technical explanation of this, what you need to be doing is looking at the stuff in the red box and looking at the size of the numbers. Now, these are odds ratios. Okay, so if these numbers are greater, don't worry about these, if these numbers are greater than one, then we have a positive diversity effect. Or a positive diversity link. If it's less than one, then it's negative. The more stars, the better, if you want diversity to be good for firms' performance. So this is what we call a result significant at the 1% level. That's kind of the strongest result that we're testing for. This stuff is not statistically significant, although it has a positive, the number is positive. So these are measures of whether the firm does product innovation. It's about process innovation. And what we find here is, you know, firms which are migrant diverse relative to firms which have just UK-born owners and partners are more likely to innovate. Okay, they're more likely to introduce new products and services or modifications to the product and service line. So if you think that innovation is good, that means that diversity is positive, has a positive association. And we find some similar results on the process innovation side for firms with all migrant top teams. So this is telling us that there are, you know, nice positive connections between firms' management and certain things the firms do, controlling away for all the other stuff that I showed you earlier. The next thing we do is to look at whether that translates into increased revenue, and although we find plenty of positive coefficients, we don't find any significant effects. So this may be pointing to, you know, there may be a number of things behind this. This may reflect discrimination in product markets. This may reflects sort of a different skill set, having an idea and taking it to market. There are a number of things that might be behind this, which I'll come back to later. We also look at the different types of firms that might be doing this. So in a lot of the literature, and when people like Richard Florida write about this stuff, they spend a lot of time talking about knowledge-intensive firms, you know, companies which are financial services or sort of working in science and technology, where people are bouncing concepts around all the time. You could equally see that some of these diversity effects might come in sort of ordinary firms. So a retailer which has access to new suppliers, for example, that would count as a sort of innovation that we're interested in. So what we try and do here is look at the separate effect of knowledge-intensive firms versus non-knowledge-intensive firms. And basically what we're finding here is that most of the time it's the diversity effect is coming in for less knowledge-intensive firms in London. So for this type of product innovation and for process innovation, it's sort of ordinary firms where the diversity effects are kicking in. Here, it's the more knowledge-intensive firms. So in London, at any rate, you know, all businesses potentially benefit from this, not just the ones at the top end. two other things, and then we can go back to words rather than numbers. We were quite interested to see whether the characteristics of the firm influence where they sort of sold into. So what we did was to look at the share of sales within Greater London, which is called local, so the rest of the UK, which is national, and then international, which is obviously international. And when we look at migrant diverse and migrant top team firms, we find that they're significantly more likely to be sort of selling into an international market than UK run firms, and significantly less likely to be selling into the rest of the UK. So the sort of strength of these results surprised us, actually. When you look at firms which are ethnic diverse, remember this is using our sort of fuzzier measure, you get the opposite result, essentially. They seem to be much more locally orientated and selling into local markets. Again, less likely to be selling into the rest of the UK. So, you know, a number of the different channels which I showed you earlier are operating here. These measures are not precise enough for us to work out whether these are always the same firms, although we could go back and look at that. But there are, you know, London's international connectivity and London's large and diverse home markets are things that these firms are taking advantage of. So a sort of a richer picture here than you might have expected. The last thing we did was to look at reasons for firm formation. So we have a much smaller number of firms here rather than 7,000, where we can identify the people who set the firm up. Labs happily asks them why they did it, and remember that we're taking their answers at face value here, so bear that caveat in mind. We clustered the reasons into three types. So there are reasons which we called entrepreneurial reasons. So people said things like, I spotted a gap in the market, or I wanted to do my own thing. There are reasons which we characterise as representing some kind of lockout. So people said, I couldn't get another job, I was unemployed, my business collapsed. This is the only thing I could do. And then there were reasons which fell between those two extremes. So we then looked at whether, for the founders, we then looked at whether migrant status had any effect on giving these reasons. And we found this is set up a different way, so this is just a positive result. We found a sort of small but quite significant link between being a migrant founder versus a UK-born founder and setting your firm up for entrepreneurial reasons. So that, I mean, this is just an association. It's difficult to back out everything that might have gone before this, but I think this is giving us some indication that sort of the migrant entrepreneurship story in London has some basis in reality. Okay. The other thing we do is run a whole bunch of robustness checks on these results, which I can show you if you really want to see them. What we do survives pretty much everything that we throw at it, although we can't fully control for causality quite as much as we'd like to. We think, you know, these are pretty nice results. Okay, so what does this tell us? So look, thinking about the wider diversity effects rather than the labour market effect, London's cultural diversity seems to help London businesses. This is what all those tables are telling me. So we have positive links from diversity to ideas generation, but not to commercialisation of those ideas. We need to think about why that is. There seems to be, there are effects across London's economic distribution. So not only for knowledge-intensive firms, diversity seems to have a stronger effect for less knowledge-intensive firms. All migrant teams, it's the converse. It's a stronger effect for knowledge-intensive businesses. Migrant-headed and migrant-diverse firms sell largely to international markets. Firms which have at least half minority ethnic owners and partners are more localised in their sales strategy. And as I was saying, there's a sort of small but robust link from migrant status to entrepreneurial behaviour, at least in terms of firm formation. So, as far as I know, this is the first study that's done this. If we had better data, we could do even more. But at the moment, we don't. So what does this tell us? I think there are a few issues for policymakers. I mean, this is probably more of a London one than a national one, but in theory, the sort of the innovation effects that we identified should come through to commercialisation effects. I mean, we're trying to figure out why this might not be the case.
You know, one reason is that
the ideas that all these firms have are just bad ideas, which are not going to work. Who knows?
Perhaps a more plausible one is that the kind of
skills you need for developing an idea, or sort of setting up a firm, developing an idea, taking that idea to market and making a success of it, are very different skill sets. So we're genuinely measuring two different aspects of business performance. Something
that might back this out is in the recent paper that Neil's done, looking at small businesses across the UK, and basically asks
these firms what they identify as barriers to their own growth.
And firms which are sort of minority ethnic group headed identify management experience and sort of
business skills as key barriers to their growth. So this is UK-wide rather than London, but it's providing general support for this point about skill sets. If we had a true panel of firms and could kind of track them through time, we could measure commercialisation over many years rather than just 1 year. So we may be missing some of what firms do. There may be other sort of constraints to success, discrimination, as mentioned earlier, finance, lack of space, the things that stop small businesses doing as well as they want to do. A lot of these are policy failures as well as sort of market coordination issues, and that suggests certainly potential for stronger business support policies across the Greater London area. Two other points. What does this tell us about current immigration policies, or at least the economics of those policies rather than politics? They don't look like a good idea. So if you believe the results I've told you, restricting London's talent pool is not a good idea. In particular, if you're interested in promoting entrepreneurship, restricting the pool of migrants is not a good idea. The entrepreneurship visa keeps the door open, but it keeps the door open if you can bring 50k of funding to the table, which obviously not all potential entrepreneurs are going to be able to do. And some of the restrictions on post-study visas may have a similar effect when you come in later this year. Finally, a point about labour market institutions in London. And this is going back to some of the evidence I was showing you earlier. People like George Borjas, who are sort of immigration sceptics, make this quite powerful argument that, suppose these diversity effects are real and firms start changing their hiring behaviour, then there are workers who would have been hired who might not now be hired, okay? Because firms are going for more diverse teams. And so, in the short term, those guys are losers in the economic terminology. I mean, in London, the issue is what else they would have done. And in an economy like this one, it's a big, diverse city which got away with it in the recession, these guys might not be losers for very long. However, the evidence we've got about the way certain sectors of the London economy are adapting around immigrant labour flows suggests that some of these guys might be locked out for longer than others. That suggests a case for re-regulating, I think, certainly employment agency activity, minimum wage and working conditions around those parts of the labour market, and also more effective employment and training for lower skilled landowners. And to conclude, here are some things that we'd like to do next, but we can talk about those later. Thank you.
So I'll open up to general questions, but if I could have the first.
Sure.
I mean, firstly, the first question is not really a fair one because it's asking you to comment on something you've not particularly spoken about. But I suppose just to raise a more geography rather than the economics focus, about whether there's any concern in terms of the broader focus of the paper. In a sense, there's a slight sort of undertow of justifying sort of immigration debate through, well, don't they earn their keep? Well, rather than saying, well, maybe we shouldn't be focusing on that, and there'd be a sort of moral justification for immigration otherwise, without people needing to prove their entrepreneurial credentials. And then the second one, which might relate more directly, is to just ask in terms of whether there's any way that you thought through in policy terms whether this your findings impact across London in different ways, whether you're looking very much at London as a single entity or whether there are sort of sub-regional impacts.
Sure. Shall I take that one, and does anyone have any other burning questions they want to drop in? Yeah.
Well, I wonder why you move so swiftly to it's a bad idea to have an immigration cap, because if these firms have really good ideas but they're no good at commercialising them, I don't see how they, you know, actually produce anything more than less innovative firms.
Sure, let me come back to that. Okay.
Can we just do the who we are as well?
That was part of that last question.
Let me take your points first and then come back to that last one. I mean, on the sort of the setup, I mean, this is very deliberately looking at the economics of this rather than the broader justifications you might bring to the table. And that's simply because we know very, very little about what the wider economic effects actually are. That's not to say these are the only things that matter. So there are a whole load of wider conversations that you would want to have if you were arguing the pros and cons of this. This is just one of the things that I think you'd want to bring to the table. Your question about different parts of London, I mean, the short answer is it's difficult with this data to break it down within London because you just don't have enough firms in the sample to really know what you're getting. I think with sort of bigger, richer data sets, you could look at different local economies, but using this data set, it's hard to do. I mean, this is taking the numbers to pretty much the limit. So there are certainly other ways that you could get at that. The type of thing Susie's doing, which is more qualitative, you know, based on going out and walking the street and actually identifying all the firms, will get you to some of the local differences in a way that this isn't quite able to do. I think you could, but, you know, there's probably some descriptors that you could break out of this, but I'm not sure that they would get you, you know, further than just broad brush description. I mean, the question about sort of generating ideas and then making money out of them, I mean, we just, you know, that is one of the explanations for the result, but not the only one. So, I mean, it could be that there are plenty of good ideas and these firms are constrained in getting them out and getting them to market rather than just being unable to do so. You know, we know that most of the firms in the sample are relatively young and that they're trying, you know, that many of them will probably not be here in a few years' time. That's just part of the, you know, general high rates of turnover for small businesses in London. I mean, what, you know, to take this back to what Jane Jacobs would say, you know, you need a big and economically diverse set of ideas in the city in order to maximise your economic chances in the long term, and in order to generate spillovers across the different types of businesses and different ways of doing things in the city. And, you know, London exhibits those kind of cross-sectoral spillovers to a very great extent. And there's another piece of work that I'm doing at the moment looking at, tech startups in East London. And there's a clear story of, you know, cross-pollination of ideas and perspectives and ways of working across different types of firms. So, you know, arbitrarily pulling up the gates or turning the tap or whatever metaphor is that you want to do it without any sort of sense of the economics behind that is not healthy policy. If you're concerned with fostering entrepreneurship, you know, growing the business base, growing London's economic resilience. Yes.
So my question really follows on in terms of the level of disaggregation, and it may just not be possible from this kind of data set, which I'm not familiar with. And were you able to actually look at different types of business and different national or ethnic groups in terms of this relationship between entrepreneurial and actually making money? Because in the whole debate about what is most effective in terms of economic growth and to what extent economic growth can actually be bottom up, that kind of information would actually be quite useful. Such as Sir Duncan Bower, University of Westminster.
Sure. I mean, again, there's more detail. There's more detail in the paper. Quite a lot more detail. But the kind of the headline here is this basically. I mean, this is a cut between firms like retail and consumer services and firms which are at the sort of the higher end of the higher end of the sort of the value chain. And we're finding that there are, you know, positive diversity effects for all of these types of firms. What we also do in the paper, I think, is to sort of break it down within this group, so to look at the difference between financial services, business services, etc. And there are, you know, again, there are sort of generally positive effects at that more detailed sexual level as well. You know, you could use that, I think, with, you know, alongside an economic development strategy, if you had sectors that you wanted to promote, and see, you know, to what extent, you know, this is an important influence on growth and on performance. Control it, you know, and look at the relative effect of top team composition alongside all of the other factors that I showed you in the model. I think that would be the way that you'd want to do it. Some of that is possible from what we've got here. Yeah.
But that could lead on to, you know, decisions if there was a regenerating authority which had funding like the LDO used to have in terms of their policies on SMEs, for example, whether that could actually lead to a more focused investment strategy.
Absolutely.
Which could be quite important in terms of generating economic growth.
Yeah. I mean, this is probably an overly academic answer, but I mean, what you really want to do, you know, is gather this data again and see if the things have changed. So this is showing you what was going on, you know, in the very recent past, but there are reasons to think that you might have, you know, slightly different results now, I think, in 2012 as opposed to 2007. I think given the kind of big trends that I showed you at the beginning of the paper, they're not going to be very different, but I think you'd want to go back and double check it before you took it to policy. Yeah, Ian.
Just to pick up Duncan's last point about the LDO, and one of the striking things is this is a data set gathered for the LDO to which the LDO has access. There's no evidence that they're going to have any sort of interest in this. So this is a conspicuous failure of the government. Firstly, in gathering data which they may be open to use, and secondly, in shutting down the data set. So I should look to the LDA's next disappearance as an explanation. The second thing relates to Duncan's question is about how we relate this to immigrants in general. Because it seems to be I don't think you share this, but the overall rate of entrepreneurship amongst migrant communities and non-migrants is higher. It's been very different between some groups, but it's not been conspicuously high. Against even an English benchmark. So I think it would be really important to try and identify who it is that we're talking about and on what basis they enter the country. Because it can't just be a question of overall caps on numbers. It must be something to do with which groups actually bring entrepreneurship, which groups actually produce a relevant to the capital. We can think of lots of examples of groups that have almost zero.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this is what we want to try and look at next if we can. I mean, this, you know, as Ian was saying, I don't think the LDA fully appreciated the value of this data set. Having collected all this incredibly rich data, they then did fairly simple things with it. And they were, you know, surprised and pleased when we showed them the results of this analysis, which they hadn't realised they could do. However, you know, this data set doesn't give you any more detail than I've showed you about exactly who, you know, the firm founders are. We had to do quite a lot of playing around with the data in order to identify firm founders by birth country in the first place. So it's not something that leaps out of the data. You know, much richer stuff on this would be very, very helpful. And as Ian says, the kind of qualitative research that's been done suggests some very big differences between identity groups. Linked to, you know, a whole host of other factors, you know, class, income, diasporic links, you know, sort of positions within UK society. So there are, you know, there's a whole sort of set of other issues that are, you know, buried under the aggregate findings that I've shown you.
Could I pursue that for a minute? Because when you say other factors, which I'm sure you're right about, class and income and yes, wealth and access to finance, which figured in one of your possible other factors. I mean, react to politeness, how you react to my very sort of common sense casual observation. But ultimate relations to these products or processes, if they're good, then you should get snapped up by somebody else. You know, the people who do the innovation often don't have the resources, access to finance, blah blah blah, to fully exploit them. But they sell it to Google, or they sell it to somebody, and it becomes part of the intellectual capital of the product mix and the larger enterprise. And that, my impression is that's how a lot of growth takes place. Now, if that, to sort of explore that hypothesis, you would need some longitudinal data on interview firms, and track them and follow them. But do you have any kind of comment or action? It could well be that all this flourishing of innovation is all captured.
I mean, that it's possible if we could track these firms through time that we would see that. I mean, what I would say is that what we've got here is unlikely to be explained by, you know, the buy up, the acquisition, the stealing of the idea, because it's simply, you know, it's looking at what is going on within a given firm in a given year. And if you think about the kind of the, you know, the reality of commercializing your idea, it's probably going to take longer than that. This is why I think we probably underestimated the sort of the commercialization effect. I mean, and that, you know, you're absolutely right to identify that sort of, you know, exit through acquisition as one of the things that is where a lot of innovations end up. But that can take quite some time to happen. So, you know, in a kind of very dynamic economy like the South Bay area, you know, that process can take years and years and years of grafting and pushing an idea forward until Google spots it and then buys it. So, you know, that would be a sort of a long history. I mean, the jury is out on whether that is the best way, you know, for a sort of sector or an urban economy to grow. I mean, certainly a lot of the small firms that I talk to want to have their ideas bought out by a bigger firm. That's one of the things that they're aiming at. You know, they will then go on and, you know, start the cycle again, because they don't want to be in a large organisation forever. I mean, you know, the economic literature is not clear on whether that sort of buyout dynamic or the sort of lots of small business dynamics are the best thing for the urban economy in the long term. I mean, both have their place, I think.
Can I go on for a second?
Sure.
The sort of quick, cheerful way of exploring that might be to look at firms which have grown a lot.
Mm.
See if they've grown through the acquisition of innovative minority businesses.
Sure. Any other questions? Yeah.
Could we possibly go back to your last slide? Because looking at the low wage worker questions, and you noted that if, in terms of migrants losing out or jobs, taking jobs, and then having other folks lose out on those jobs, those other folks are then likely to get additional jobs. And you talked about more effective employment and training for low-skilled Londoners. Can you talk a little bit more about how exactly that effect is taking place and how we can translate that into a message for the public to counter some of the foreign workers who are taking all of our low-skilled jobs?
I can have a go. I'm not sure I'm going to give you the, you know, the polished message in a seminar answer. I mean, there's another paper I've done which explores some of these issues in more detail, which, you know, a number of you have developed. What we're finding here, and I think what other research, you know, some of the work that Ian has done and other work that I've done is showing, is you basically have there's a sort of nexus of things going on. So, deregulation of entry-level work, growth of part-time and casual employment in those sectors, the entry of employment agencies en masse into some of these sectors, and the sort of the outsourcing of, large part of the hiring process to agencies. And on top of that, the availability of a lot of skilled and motivated migrant workers who those agencies will pick up, feed into the firms. You know, these are
often low quality employers who are happy with high levels of churn, you know, are not aiming to sort of build a business by developing the workforce, but are aiming at cost minimization. You know, those three things come together, you know, and the sort of the, you know, it's as if the, you know, and the sort of the UK-born workers who would be doing that entry-level work are locked out. But you can see that there's a lot more going on there than migrants taking jobs, and it's pretty important to understand that a lot of the policy takeaways are actually about that kind of stuff, rather than, you know, capping immigration and hoping that the problem will go away. Because this has been, you know, a lot of the literature suggests that this kind of stuff has been going on for a number of years. I mean, it's not just a recent thing. And track these sort of, and track the employment deregulation back to the early 80s and the mid 80s. So, you know, there's a long history of this. And, you know, although things like the, you know, Gangmasters Licensing Agency, minimum wage legislation, living wage in London, you know, all of these things are starting to get at aspects of that problem. You know, they're sort of incremental steps, and it's not clear that sort of that policymakers have that joined up view that's required. It's also not clear that, you know, some of this can be done at London level, not all of it can. So actually quite a lot of these are sort of national policy takeaways rather than GLA level stuff. You know, there are things that the mayor could do through the adult skills system here, and there are sort of, you know, there are campaigns that the mayor can run at London level, but a lot of this is national legislation. And in some cases, I'd imagine EU, you know, legislation about the activities of employment agencies rather than a local thing. So quite a complicated message, I'm afraid. But that is, you know, as I see it, what's going on. Yeah. Hi, David.
Hi, David Goodhart, Demos. I mean, just to look at the bigger picture, you said a couple of times that you think the cap is arbitrary, but clearly it's in response to very strongly felt democratic sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest that sentiment is not just outside London, it's also inside London. Indeed, London, I think, is probably the most polarised city in Britain when it comes to the immigration question. I mean, we think of it because the proportion of immigration is so high, population so high, we think that you know, anything that didn't like it sort of had a chance to get out, you know, white flag had happened. But actually, if you look at the data on people who are happy about immigration, which obviously is a huge number, London comes the highest. I think 20% of Londoners are relaxed about it or think positively about it. If you look at that Aldan, I think was it a Hope Not Hate sequel about 2 years ago, somebody did a poll saying,
yeah,
would you consider voting for a far-right party? London came top of that as well, 24%. And presumably that is mainly white Londoners, so that's 24% of 60%. So, you know, 40% of white Londoners consider voting for a far-right party. Well, this is a pretty polarised town, I would suggest. And also on the sort of on the minority contribution thing, has anybody, as far as you know, tried to do a kind of cost-benefit analysis of immigration going back a generation or two for London? I mean, given that we know that what 40% of minority Britons are in poverty compared to 20% of white Britons. So, you know, presumably, areas like Tyre and Newham have quite high levels of welfare dependency. I would have thought the net contribution to the London economy of the Tyre Hamlets or Newham is negative. But I may be wrong. I've done any figures on that.
Okay. All right. I got 3 points in there. Let's see if I missed any. I mean, as you say, the cap is not politically arbitrary at all. I mean, it's sort of economic. You know, economically, the numbers are, you know, not scientifically determined, I think you could say. But you're absolutely right. It's reflecting real political imperatives, and it would be stupid to deny that. I mean, on sort of attitudes to
sort of attitudes to immigration and diversity in London. I mean, you're right. There are, you know, people don't. Not all of the poll data tells the same story. And you know, I'm not an expert on poll data. All I'd say is that, you know, people who say they're going to vote for far right parties do it for a number of reasons. So it's not clear that you can stack those two up as complete opposites. On cost benefit analysis, I don't know of any work that's been done for London or sort of bits within it. I mean, obviously the MAC tried to do this for the UK, and you know, hugely caveated its findings. So I'd imagine that, you know, given the numbers they were using, probably the numbers that any London analysis would use, you'd have big caveats around that. I think it's tricky, given the way the London economy works, to try and pick out Borough A or Borough B, because these are not self-contained economic units. I mean, they're part of the London system. So if you were going to do this, you'd want to do it London-wide, I think, rather than trying to sort of pick an outlier and look at that. Tony had one.
Tim Travis from LSE. What you've been doing relatively micro research here, focused on companies and the way they responded to interrogation. But am I right in thinking that the findings would suggest that in areas where there were large concentrations of migrants, be they of any part, any kind, that over time, those areas would show an increase from the previous trend in entrepreneurship and indeed presumably economic growth question, as compared with another region that hadn't had or didn't have anything like that proportion of migrants within it. So if you compare, I don't know, London, or sort of London is not a big region, but London with, and it has inflows and outflows, London compared with the South West, or London compared with Stockholm, where there are relatively low numbers of migrants, would over time this begin to draw the London economy ahead as compared with the previous trends? Is there any evidence of that?
Actually, I've just persuaded Experian to give me the data that will allow me to do that for analysis, so I'll be able to give you an answer on that later, sometime later, I think. I mean, two things to bear in mind before I go away and do that work. I mean, one is that London's unique in the UK system, so you know, there's an obvious external validity problem to our results. I mean, we might not get this in other cities, although there are reasons to think we might well do. You know, if you looked at the other core cities and sort of urbanised regions, you might well find similar stuff going on. It doesn't automatically follow. The other point, and this is, you know, one that Ian has made on a number of points, is that you know, there are other things going on in cities and countries which are going to be affecting these outcomes. So even if you took London's population and put it in another region, you might not get the same kind of outcomes, because you know, different cities present different opportunities and constraints, and there are sort of different norms and expectations, particularly around sort of entrepreneurial culture between, say, London and New York, which are going to likely have an effect on the prospects and chances for any particular set of people. But there are, you know, there are reasons to think that your supposition is right, and if you know. If you were able to kind of turn up the diversity in other parts of the UK, you might get some of these effects. But remember, you know, London's critical mass, London's agglomeration economies are likely to be in the mix here in a way that they won't be by definition in other big cities. So you know, Liverpool, Manchester, Newcastle are just much smaller places. So the sort of the opportunity set for people to work off is just going to be a lot smaller than it is in the capital.
That would mean that for the implication of that would then need to be two conditions in the US. One would be being a migrant, one would be being in a huge agglomeration. If it doesn't work in Plymouth.
Yeah, if it doesn't, but we don't know that it doesn't.
No, I'm not saying it doesn't.
One reason might be that there are, you know, it's the size of London, and another reason might be that it's sort of, you know, wider, broader things about London that would stop it happening, but there's no reason why it shouldn't. Okay, all right. And I may well uncover this once I go back to the numbers. We shall see.
I can ask a second question. I go back to the issue of the data set because I don't know what it covers, and I'm just thinking about how this relates to internationalised businesses as to whether the definition of a London business has a certain threshold in terms of a level of operation, so you're basically looking only at local businesses, because there's a whole different issue surely of international labour at the top of international companies which may be based in London, may not be, who you can argue about the level of their contribution to the economy, but nevertheless they're running operations which are generating massive amounts of money. But I mean, that's a whole different debate. And what concerns me is this whole debate about migration is focusing on local businesses rather than the role of sort of international business in running corporates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether they're from America or Australia or China or India, and there are others from other nationalities. I mean, you know, the number of Lebanese who are in major roles in international financial sector in London, to take one example, and there are other obviously ethnicities and groups as well. Where do they fit into this analysis, or is this something completely different?
I mean, this, as I remember, this is a data set that looks at, you know, businesses and enterprises within London. So, you know, it's not going to be capturing multinational enterprises. You could well imagine some of the channels that I've talked about operating in these big international firms as well, with intercompany transfers being a conduit for that. And, you know, certainly if you look at the way that, you know, big businesses and big business lobby in London argues around these issues, they clearly think that that's a factor. You know, they've, big companies have been way out in front of government ministers on the immigration debate. So they clearly feel that it's, you know, being able to pick from a big talent pool, but also being able to move their people around and mix them up is important. You know, that suggests that we would have a similar story if we were able to look inside international businesses. Although obviously the kind of the configurations of the firms and the kind of markets they'd be operating in would be different. So I wouldn't be surprised to see it there as well.
Cool. With UCL. I just wondered how much that does come through, because an earlier slide you talked about big specs, I think, wasn't it, on retail? And given that if you took a kind of a distribution of firms by size, the vast majority in your cohort would be very small firms, you know, employing very few people. I mean, how much of these are basically corner shops? You're
there,
you know, little minority corner shops in different parts of London. And if that's the case, what's an innovation or an idea, you know, in terms of, and how significant would that continue then for, you know, if that's what is happening, and it may not be that's what's happening, how can you kind of then take that out to, you know,
sure,
to a wider set of firms, you know, in more kind of niche-based type firms doing other things?
Yeah, I mean, you can see in the paper, and this is, there's a longer version of this is published as a CERC working paper, which you can find on the CERC website. I mean, the, you know, the average size of these firms is relatively small, you know, so they're in the SME category, but we sort of knew that about London businesses anyway. They're not little micro businesses by and large in the way that you suggest. So, you know, they're not the kind of multinationals that Duncan was arguing about, but they are, you know, some of them are going to be, you know, news agents and you know, and sort of high street shops. Others will be, you know, small businesses working in completely different sectors, but just at a relatively early stage of growth. So the other, I mean, your other point about the type of innovation they do, I mean, that is important to understand. So the way that the survey sort of cuts it is that you have, you know, these measures of product innovation, so whether you introduce a major new product or a process, or whether you do a major modification to that. So these are quite sort of big things that firms are going to do. Buying major new equipment is the third one, and then introducing a major new way of working is the fourth one. So you know, the one that you, if you wanted to sort of shoot down the innovation measures, this is probably the one that you go for. You know, that's the most loosely specified, and you could well imagine that, you know, a company just, you know, deciding to, you know, shift working hours might want to count that as an innovation. And this is, you know, a general limitation of innovation survey data as opposed to patents or other methods of getting innovation, that you have to put suitable caveats around what managers say that they're doing, and also make sure you ask the questions in a sort of, in a suitably objective way. So, you know, you could certainly argue that these results are more reliable than these ones, but there's, you know, we have something real here in the results that we've got. And I think, you know, given what I was saying earlier about the way that much bigger firms tend to position themselves around these issues, they clearly see these sort of dynamics operating as well inside businesses.
Again, yeah. I'm being unfair by asking a question which is not part of your study, but I'm just wondering if you're aware of anything over time that would look towards whether the sort of national setting, the impact of this within the national setting, impacts over time. So I'm thinking if you were a migrant in a less entrepreneurial society, let's say UK compared to US, whether over a period of time you would envisage or do any studies to show that that you normalise over a period of maybe one or two generations and become suitably less entrepreneurial or more entrepreneurial depending on what national setting you're in. So this is the extent to which these are independent of.
Sure. Ian, you know, I mean, you've looked at that issue, haven't you? Or you're more aware of the literature, on the historical literature on this than me. I'm going to bounce it over to you. I mean, you've mentioned at least a couple of studies which have tracked at sort of community level outcomes for community X and community Y in different places.
Right? There's a comparative, I'm not sure which is, there's a comparative study of Jewish migrants to the United States and New York in the early 20th century, and there's one or maybe two different ones about Jamaicans in London, New York. And I'm not sure about the tracking of the time, but the message is very clear there that the levels of entrepreneurship are very, very much higher in the New York context, the American context, than they are in the British context. And it looks like the most plausible explanation of what they're saying is that it's picking up on the entrepreneurship of the culture to which people migrate. So some of it may be selective, but I think also people picking up on the kinds of cultural support that exist, and the radical difference there is between the US and the UK and that. And I'm not sure that this, in the discussion, I don't think it fades over time. We talk about, you know, the traditions of Jewish entrepreneurship, but we don't see it on something that's faded at all. But I think it is. It's not carried by the migrant in a simple way. It's some interaction between the migrant and the culture and the supports and the competitiveness in the place they go to.
Yeah.
Can I just comment on the sum? Because when the size of the firm thing is an issue, but this is not a simple sample of London firms, so it is skewed towards bigger establishments. So it's a stratified sum. It's not skewed as much as one might like, but it is skewed in the international. So it's an awful trip. On the other hand, I'm not sure it's actually a sample of firms. I think it's a sample of establishments, and I think there is then an issue about whether some of these firms are actually maybe actually simply branches of international ones. I'm fairly sure that's clean now, but I'd need to go back and see what they do.
I mean, a number of the people who worked on this study are no longer working for the LDA,
so it's difficult to the earlier ones that I used on the predecessor and the ones employment. So
yeah.
That's true, and one of the things you could show is that innovation is stronger than us by our own reforms. So, and I think the other thing to comment is some of the things you're showing about trade, and I suspect is very specific and quite separate from innovation. And this is people picking up, either maybe why they're here, or maybe a consequence, but picking up on particular trading relationships in home regions. That's a very interesting sort of effect, but I think it's quite different from innovation. I don't think it's a consequence of innovation.
Sure. I mean, absolutely. I wouldn't, you know, these are different aspects of what firms do. I wouldn't want you to read them as, you know, innovation and commercialization go closely together, but some of this other stuff is, as Ian said, it's measurements of different aspects. Yeah.
Two questions following up on the discussion of US versus UK. First is, how is this study, and it may not be at all, looking at some of the regulatory effects, which may make London more competitive than other parts of the UK or other parts of Europe, in terms of being able to open a firm, et cetera. And then secondly, is any of the data looking at failure rates? Because while there might be high entrepreneurship levels, you may also have 5 years out, 10 years out, massive failures or high levels of closure among firms and businesses. So I'm just wondering if any of that is taken into account in this data.
Sure. The short answers are yes and no. So, I mean, there's an enormous amount of stuff in the data set about barriers to success of various kinds that firms say are an issue. Some of that we package up into the control variables. There's other things that we could look at to extend the analysis. Because this data doesn't track firms through time, so it's not the kind of longitudinal data that Michael was talking about, we're not able to look at how these firms end up. I mean, there are much bigger data sets where we are able to do that, but they don't give information that's as rich as this about who the firms are and what they're doing. So, you know, you have to kind of trade it off, basically. Any other questions?
You were talking about training up British workers at the bottom end of the market. And the other thing you might say is could do something to expedite the integration of migrants. Because the flows we're talking about before the cap, and even more since the cap, are people better qualified than the average Londoner. So this is not an unskilled integration. It's people who go into the bottom end of the labour market disproportionately to start. Over the course of years, drift up to a normal profile within the labour market. And if there were ways of actually expediting that process, that would have just as positive results. It would have positive results for other people in that segment of the market.
But I mean, how would you define economic? I mean, this is integration within a labour market. I mean, what would be a kind of policy takeaway from that? How would you actually do it? Sort of, I know what you're getting at.
I mean, you would ease the learning of English to start with for people who don't have it as an economic benefit rather than simply a social one. You might also look at other effective blockages. So why is it that people with apparently good degrees are actually doing fairly lousy jobs for some time? I'm sure it's not just discrimination, but there must be discrimination element to that. But there are things which shouldn't take quite so long to overcome.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, the thing that's tricky about that is to try and filter out some of the life cycle stuff that's going on. So if you look at surveys of AA migrants in particular, a lot of them are, you know, highly skilled young people who are basically coming over to London for a few years, you know, working in whatever job, and then if you ask them, this is what they say, you know, thinking about going home afterwards. And some people stay and they sort of integrate into the mainstream labour market in the way that you've suggested, and others don't. And try to, you know, I think sort of fitting people onto one path or another is tricky to do, I think. Asking people, you know, whether they're definitely going to integrate or are not interested is, you know, it's hard because people's decisions change over time, and their priorities change over time as well. So trying to, you know, cut it that way, I think, would be important, and potentially much harder to do, I think, than just assuming one integration track.
Any other questions or comments? If not, I'm going to thank you very much for what was a very fascinating presentation, which I think actually was very useful in kind of highlighting the amount of things we don't know about the subject, more than anything else. But thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Thank you for the virtue we find on that.
If you go if you go here, we'll just search for Max Nathan LSE, you should find it.
Studio project was on Mile End Road.
I vaguely remember Philip talking about it.
Yeah, we sort of went on there in a big case of it, sort of these, we hypothesized about these benefits of having migrants. So it's kind of nice to have some actual hard data supporting.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much the beginning of the agenda.
Yeah, I see that. No, yeah, as we kind of fleshed out here. But,
I mean, the numbers tell the story that we think you want them to tell.
Yeah.
You want them to tell. That's helpful.
Absolutely. Cool. Yeah.
So what are you doing now? Are you still here?
Well, actually, the way I heard about this tonight, I was... I'm working on a small startup front, but I don't know how far that's going to go. And some other friends and I from the Cities program were interested in sort of the Silicon Roundabout and that whole sort of tech city idea.
Right.
And that's where I found you.
Okay, yeah, so I'm talking about that on Wednesday.
Oh, are you?
Yeah,
Is it cost anything or is that one free?
No, it's free.
On Wednesday night?
Yeah, there's something about it. I think I blogged something about it, but it's on the
blog. Yeah, I found this night through your blog. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So there's the most recent post. I think it talks about that one as well. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Well, have a look at that. Yeah.
Purely qualitative research. So
right.
It's kind of numbers free and quotes rich.
Because the three of us sat down. One's an architect, one's a planner, and then I've got sort of a business and then the Cities program background. And we were trying to think of sort of a long-term framework to sort of support that. But I first said we should probably find out what everyone else has done.
Yeah.
And then I found that you guys were working on this.
Very good. Thank you.
How far along are you guys in developing sort of the tech city framework?
It's going to be, we're going to publish it in July. So it's a very quick bit of work.
Yeah.
And the policy, as you'll see, if you come along, I mean, the policy framework is just not really there at all. So there was a speech by Cameron. There are some things that the GLA is starting to think about. There were a few announcements which were sort of tagged as Tech City, but we still don't really know what's there in enough detail to be able to do anything, which is what this project is.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of money and interest in it, but not a lot backing it up.
Really. Well, there's a million quid from the technology strategy.
Right.
That's quite good.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Well, that's right. Okay. Last thing we had in the talk by Guy was on the government's immigration. So she was discussing how the craziness of the targets. Also in terms of the net.
No.
The government.
relief of
Yeah.